This is a CBC podcast.
I think we all understand that this gap in our healthcare system must be closed. We may disagree on exactly how to close it, but that's not a reason to abandon the field and abandon people who need medication.
A federal pharmacare plan aimed at bringing Canadians long-lasting relief hasn't exactly been fast-acting. But after a complex deal with the NDP and a hard fight in Parliament, a bill to cover diabetes drugs and contraception is now law. Still, it's just one step towards universal drug coverage. Up next, convincing provinces to get on board. Welcome to Your World Tonight. It's Friday, October 11th, just before 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Tom Harrington. Also on the podcast.
I try to get to my dad, but I couldn't get to him because the only way to get to him is that back door there. And it was too much water to get through to him.
Heartbreaking loss in a devastating storm. Florida residents are returning home now after Hurricane Milton, with some communities still underwater and without power or gasoline. Now the massive effort begins to rebuild homes, communities, and lives. The Liberal NDP PharmaCare bill passed the Senate last night. The next phase of making the National Prescription Drug Program a reality begins today. Only one province has signed on so far to cover diabetes and birth control medication. Tom Perry looks at what's next and the politics at play.
Right now, my sugars are running a little high, and that's because that I just got done lunch.
Keeping track of his diabetes is all part of Roger Cook's daily routine. He's got insurance through his employer to help pay for his medication, but it doesn't cover everything.
When I look at my medicine that I buy, and plus the other medicines that go along that support it. And with diabetes, there's other complications, which means there's other medicines that you take. I am sure I'm looking at $200 to $250 a month at this current time.
With the federal government's PharmaCare legislation now law, Cook hopes his province, New Brunswick, will sign on. The law aims to cover the cost of diabetes and birth control medication, the foundation for a full national PharmaCare program.
This is a big deal and great news for many Canadians.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcomed the new law's passing as he wrapped up a summit in Southeast Asia. The legislation was part of the now defunct deal between the Liberals and New Democrats that saw the NDP propping up the government in a minority parliament.
We have been able to achieve something New Democrats have fought for generations.
With the PharmaCare framework now in place, NDP leader Jagmeet Singh isn't saying how much longer his party will continue to support the government in the House.
This bill is passed. Now we want to see deals signed. So our focus is on forcing this Liberal government to get those deals signed.
Ottawa has a memorandum of understanding with British Columbia that outlines broadly how the federal plan could roll out there. Ontario and Alberta have expressed skepticism. Still, Federal Health Minister Mark Holland thinks some provinces could start signing on by spring.
And so I would say to provinces, this is an important opportunity. This is an important opportunity to make sure the people who need medication get it.
But in this minority parliament, an election could come at any time. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, whose party holds a commanding lead in the polls, doesn't back the Liberal proposal, claiming it's a threat to private drug insurance plans. The law is passed, but the future of PharmaCare is far from certain. Tom Perry, CBC News, Ottawa.
In Quebec, access to a family doctor may be about to change in a very controversial way. The province is mulling a plan which would reallocate medical appointments from healthier patients to more vulnerable ones. Jennifer Yoon reports.
Been way big for me. And tip your head back.
The Quebec government is considering an unprecedented solution to the family doctor shortage, limiting access to family doctors if you're relatively healthy. The idea is to give vulnerable people first priority to care. A new report from Quebec's Health Research Institute, commissioned by the province, says 500,000 Quebecers with complex and chronic health conditions don't have a family doctor. These include people with cancer, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes.
Si on veut s'occuper correctement des gens,
the province's health minister, Christian Dubé, suggests it's a way to take care of people properly. While the details of the proposed plan are unclear, among Quebecers, there's already a mixed reaction.
If it's for vulnerable people that really needs a doctor, family doctor, I mean, I don't mind.
I think it's not right. You might be well today, might not be well tomorrow, right?
That's a dumb idea. Everybody should be treated.
Sources tell Radio-Canada the government has been studying the scenario for months. Anyone who would lose their doctor would be referred to an online program or a phone hotline to get their symptoms assessed by a nurse and book an appointment with the doctor if necessary.
My first reaction is concern for the doctors involved as well as the patients.
Quebec family doctor Laura Sang understands the goal is to increase care for the vulnerable, but she says taking care away from healthy people means that more of them could get sick.
The crisis that we're experiencing now reflects what happens when you're in that reactive state and you're just reacting to people who are sick.
She's also worried the approach will increase the stress on family doctors, and more of them may burn out or leave the public system.
The thing about family medicine is everybody needs us eventually.
It's a fear Toronto family doctor Danielle Martin shares. She thinks there are so many other options on the table to address the shortage. She says this proposed plan is like throwing in the towel.
Every single person, whether they are young and healthy or whether they have multiple chronic diseases, needs access to a relationship with a primary care provider or a team, a family doctor, and I don't think that the Quebec government should give up on that goal.
Martin says the Quebec government should be prioritizing solutions, like paying doctors more so they stay in the public system, instead of disrupting existing relationships between patients and doctors. Jennifer Yoon, CBC News, Toronto.
Two people have been arrested in connection with that deadly fire in an old Montreal building last week. The suspects are men, aged 18 and 20, who are known to police. Jean-Sébastien Caron is with the Montreal Police Major Crimes Unit.
Evidence gathered during the investigation indicate that one of them set fire to building using an incendiary object, while the other drove a getaway vehicle following the outbreak of the fire. We were working closely with the prosecutor of the Director of Criminal and Penal Prosecution. A decision on the charge will be known within the next 24 hours.
Police say they have not yet determined a motive. A mother and her 7-year-old daughter, visiting from France, died in the fire. Two other people were injured, with one still recovering in hospital. A woman from Montreal has been charged with aggravated assault causing bodily harm. She allegedly scalded a 10-year-old black boy with boiling water. The child suffered serious burns to his head, face, torso, and back. Stephanie Borel was arrested immediately after the incident last week, but was released on conditions. That prompted calls from a lobby group that fights racism to reverse the decision. Police say after further investigation, the 46-year-old was rearrested today. Coming right up, Milton may be gone, but the broken buildings and shattered lives the storm left behind will take years to mend. Plus, getting access to an emergency room in New Brunswick is a central issue in that province's election campaign, driven in part by what happened to an Ontario couple. Later, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to a Japanese anti-nuclear group almost 80 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's a different kind of flooding challenge in Florida tonight. Highways are clogged by traffic as people who fled Hurricane Milton are making the trek back home, hoping to assess the damage and start the cleanup. Hard to do when millions are still without power. Officials say at least 16 people are dead. The CBC's Katie Simpson is in Florida near some of the worst-hit communities.
Traffic barely moved along the main highway from central Florida to the Gulf Coast. People who fled Milton's path are starting to return home, a journey made all the more difficult by gas shortages all over the state. As floodwaters begin to subside and power crews get more customers back online, Governor Ron DeSantis warned some hard-hit areas remain dangerous.
We have had fatalities because of interaction with downed power lines and water. We are seeing hazards that are still there. So please exercise caution.
Most of the deaths from Hurricane Milton happened in communities hit by tornadoes with little warning. Authorities say things could have been much worse had people directly in the storm's path not taken evacuation orders seriously. Search and rescue efforts are still the priority. More than 1,000 people have been brought to safety so far.
Where's everybody at?
Including a family of eight in Hillsborough County after 2 meters of floodwater entered their home. But first responders could not get to everyone, even in communities far from the coast that were not under evacuation orders.
We did the body recovery rescue for my dad.
Amy Welsh lives in a mobile home in the city of Lakeland, about 40 minutes southwest of Orlando. Her 61-year-old dad, a paraplegic with serious health issues, lived in the trailer next door.
I tried to get to my dad, but I couldn't get to him. And it was too much water to get through to him.
Floodwaters rushed into the trailer park. Her dad was in danger, but the conditions were too dangerous.
And I called 911 and asked if they can come and help us rescue. If we had one more person that was strong enough, they could help us get them out. They said they can't send nobody right now.
Welsh tried flagging down neighbors and strangers for help, but it wasn't until the storm passed that her partner, Matt, and some neighbors could finally get into her father's trailer.
Matt comes back to tell me that my dad is passed away.
When they found him, his body was dry. They don't think he drowned.
And I honestly think that probably what took him is the stress of thinking that he were going to drown there because he was unable to walk to get out, and I couldn't get to him.
Welsh's 11-year-old daughter comes to her side and rubs her back as she tells her story. She's grateful to be surrounded by her family and to have them close as they navigate through this moment of grief. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Lakeland, Florida.
Hurricane Milton did not turn out to be the worst storm in a century, but it might be the worst ever for hurricane forecasters. They say they're in shock over accusations leveled at them by conspiracy theorists. They're claiming the weather experts created and controlled the storm to hurt Donald Trump. As Paul Hunter reports, it's just the latest example of misinformation being deployed in U.S. politics with devastating effect.
All right, so whoever needs to hear this message, here it is.
After the mess left by Hurricanes Helene and now Milton, it's, in a sense, the aftermath of the aftermath, a storm of online conspiracy theories politicizing both natural disasters. In this one, a man on TikTok, calling himself Mr. Burns, urges his followers to rise up against migrants on the false claim the U.S. government has diverted hurricane disaster relief money to illegal immigrants.
We're not asking no more. Our government is clearly standing in opposition against us. They don't want us to help locals. They don't want us to help our own kind. They want the migrants to have America. Let's get a convoy full of people. Let's go up here and take over this area.
And on a podcast called Jesus, Guns, and Babies, host Candace Taylor, a Republican Party official in Georgia, repeated false claims Helene was manipulated by the U.S. government, in part to suppress Republican voters.
The whole thing with North Carolina, I know that it's a grab for the land. It's a land grab, and they want the lithium. But I also believe they don't want the voters turning out that are all around Asheville, those Republican red voters.
And so it goes, amplified by Donald Trump himself at campaign rallies as he makes his push for a return to the White House, falsely suggesting federal aid has been effectively absent, said Joe Biden today.
The misinformation out there is not only just disgusting, but it's dangerous. It's misleading.
What might dangerous mean? That those who need help might no longer seek it out. But for some, it's more than that. A meteorologist in Lansing, Michigan, Katie Nicolau, got a text message seemingly based on a conspiracy theory that she took as a death threat. Posting it on X, she wrote, "Murdering meteorologists won't stop hurricanes."
And my question is, when did that become okay?
At a rally for Kamala Harris yesterday in Pittsburgh, former President Barack Obama slammed Trump for pushing misinformation forward.
Everybody knew it wasn't true. Even local Republicans said it was not true. You have a guy who will just lie about it to score political points, and this has consequences.
It also comes with just over 3 weeks until the presidential election. The contest is effectively a dead heat, as conspiracy theories abound. Paul Hunter, CBC News, Washington.
Concerns tonight over the safety of peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. Israel's military admitted today it had fired on a UN building there. Antonio Guterres is the UN's Secretary General.
Peacekeepers must be protected by all parties of the conflict. And what has happened is obviously condemnable. This incident is intolerable and it cannot be repeated.
The IDF says it is carrying out operations against Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. Officials say they were responding to a threat near the UN post. Two workers were injured. The UN says it's the second straight day Israel has targeted the area. Two other peacekeepers were hurt on Thursday. The crisis playing out in many Canadian emergency rooms is a key issue in New Brunswick's election campaign. Hospitals in the province are struggling with staffing shortages and patient wait times. But with less than 2 weeks away from the vote, there's a renewed plea for solutions, sparked by the tragedy of one Ontario couple. Kayla Hounsell explains.
He was coming up on retirement. He was a really decent human being.
Ottawa resident Anne McCool says she and her husband Danny were drawn to the Maritimes. They honeymooned here, brought their children here.
I'll never not love the Maritimes, but it's certainly been colored by my experience in Moncton.
McCool says they were on the second day of vacation in August last year and may have had some bad soup on a stopover in Sackville, New Brunswick. Danny said he was having a lot of abdominal pain, but it was after operating hours for the ER at Sackville Memorial. McCool called 911. Paramedics brought her husband to the Moncton Hospital, around 50 kilometers away.
Every hour that went by, he was getting sicker and sicker.
McCool says her husband was largely ignored for hours in the ER, his vitals not checked at appropriate intervals. An autopsy report shows he died the next day after an infection in his intestines.
They just made a decision that, you know, this guy has food poisoning. Why is she bothering us?
In a statement to CBC News, the president and CEO of the health authority, Horizon Health, said, "I spoke with the family of the deceased to offer a sincere apology on behalf of our organization for the lack of communication and compassion they experienced." She did not offer a further explanation. Healthcare is a major issue in the New Brunswick election campaign. McCool has contacted all of the main parties to share her experience and urge them to come up with solutions.
Some of the bold pledges concern healthcare.
Gabriel Arsenault is a political scientist at the University of Moncton. He is tracking the party promises.
The Green Party originally was a party whose main mission was the defense of the environment. Now its number one priority is healthcare.
All of the main parties are talking about healthcare.
This should not have happened.
In 2022, New Brunswickers protested after three people died in various ER waiting rooms. An inquest into one of those deaths resulted in recommendations aimed at improving ER services.
I spend a lot of time in the emergency department when I'm on calls.
Dr. Chris Goodyear is a general surgeon in Fredericton. He's calling on the election winners to spend 48 hours in an ER.
New Brunswickers and Canadians are frustrated. And when they don't have access to the system via family doctor or nurse practitioner, you're going to see overcrowded emergency rooms.
McCool supports Goodyear's challenge.
If it's a crisis in New Brunswick, it's becoming a crisis everywhere.
She is urging Canadians to advocate for their loved ones if they're not getting the care they need. Kayla Hounsell, CBC News, Moncton.
Advocating for children is at the heart of our next story. Food insecurity is on the rise in Canada, as are grocery store prices. The federal government has announced a new national school food program, but not many provinces are helping themselves to it. Deanna Sumanak-Johnson reports.
Okay, how many more, guys?
At Rennies River Elementary School in St. John's, freshly prepared hot lunches for students don't have to break the bank. Families pay what they can or nothing at all. But meals like these can now be enjoyed by more children in Newfoundland and Labrador thanks to a new school food program deal announced by the federal government in the spring. John Finn is the president of the charity School Lunch Association.
We're working closely with the province right now and looking at, you know, high socioeconomic needs, areas where there is a huge demand for a program.
It's up to each province to sign on to the federal program, similar to child care. Then that money gets divvied up between the patchwork of organizations that currently run school food programs. But so far, only Newfoundland and Labrador has signed on to get its $9.1 million slice of the pie. For some families in Ontario, home to 40% of Canada's school children, the holdup is excruciating.
The time is now.
Jessica Stevenson runs the Niagara Nutrition Partners School Food Program. She says soaring food prices, more families needing help, and increased population in the area are making this situation the perfect storm.
About a year or so ago, we were forced to shut down 13 programs 3 months early. And so that's 13 schools worth of children that didn't have food in their bellies.
Like other school meal charities, this one runs on a combination of private donations and provincial and municipal funds. But the federal money is badly needed.
If Ontario signs as quickly as we think it will, we think that'll have a big implication for others. We know Manitoba and PEI are very close to signing as well.
Debbie Field is the national coordinator for Coalition for Healthy School Food. It has been consulting governments on how to make the program healthy, culturally appropriate, and more sustainable.
And what governments all around the world are realizing is that it is one of their wisest investments, long term.
An investment to the tune of $1 billion over 5 years divided across provinces to help make sure lunches like this one at Rennie's River School in St. John's.
Today we got macaroni and cheese, mixed vegetables, garlic bread.
Get to fill more bellies and fuel more young minds. Deanna Sumanak-Johnson, CBC News, Toronto.
Economists say today's positive job numbers suggest the country's economy may be on the rebound. New data from Statistics Canada shows 47,000 positions were added in September. Young people and women aged 25 to 54 driving those gains. Unemployment fell to 6.5%, the lowest rate since January. Some experts, however, are still predicting another interest rate cut to offset borrowing costs. The central bank's next decision is October 23rd. They survived the world's first atomic bombs, then spent their lives advocating for an end to nuclear weapons. For that, a Japanese group is being given this year's Nobel Prize for Peace. As Julia Wong tells us, their message is still relevant nearly 80 years later.
That monstrous cloud that billowed over Nagasaki in 1945 after U.S. troops dropped an atomic bomb. The use of nuclear weapons here and over Hiroshima changed everything.
Here and there, an isolated structure reminds the onlooker that here was once a city.
The aftermath, catastrophic, as buildings were flattened and swaths of both cities were destroyed by fire. Tens of thousands of people died during the bombings and from burns and radiation injuries in the years to follow. Since that fateful day, a grassroots organization called Nihon Hidankyu, made up of survivors, has been calling for a world free of nuclear weapons. Today, their efforts were given a prestigious honor.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Peace Prize for 2024 to the Japanese organization Nihon Hidankyu.
The survivors are known as Hibakusha, a word specifically referring to survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
The Hibakusha helps us describe the indescribable, to think the unthinkable, and to grasp the incomprehensible pain and suffering caused by nuclear weapons.
In Japan, the co-chair of Nihon Hidankyu was visibly shocked when the group got the news. He spoke through tears. "It can't be real. It can't be real," he says, adding, "We will appeal to the world as we always have done, for the abolition of nuclear weapons and the achievement of an everlasting peace." However, the award came with a grim warning from the Nobel Committee.
The nuclear powers are modernizing and upgrading their arsenals. New countries appear to be preparing to acquire nuclear weapons, and threats are being made to use nuclear weapons as part of ongoing warfare.
But apathy is part of the problem, according to Daniel Hogsta, the deputy director of International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the Peace Prize in 2017, says this year's winner could not have come at a better time.
What this means is, what it needs to mean is political leaders around the world need to wake up to the risk of nuclear weapons and need to heed the call of the Hibakusha, which is very clear. We need to prohibit and eliminate nuclear weapons.
Next year will mark 80 years since the atomic bombs were dropped. With the number of survivors dwindling, this award brings hope for a nuclear-free world after they're gone. Julia Wong, CBC News, Edmonton.
We close by setting sail for blue waters and a greener future. It may be an answer to a major climate problem that's blowing in the wind.
Every container of coffee that we receive in North America, where coffee does not grow, already has one ton or close to one ton of CO2 associated with it just because of the maritime transport.
Serge Picard is the co-owner of Quebec-based Café William, a coffee company looking for cleaner ways to get its beans from Colombia to the port of Quebec City. Last year, it partnered with Transoceanic Wind Transport, a French-based shipping startup. Instead of traditional cargo ships, it uses a fleet of sailboats. Guillaume Legrand is the company's founder and CEO.
I've always been sort of astounded by the power of wind, and we don't do anything with it instead of just, you know, for pleasure-seeking purposes. That sail, when you use it as a principal solution, is not something from the past, but actually for the future in terms of properly decarbonizing shipping.
There are only a handful of wind-powered ships currently on the water. While it may sound quaint or old-timey, these are serious vessels. This week, Transoceanic's 81-meter-long schooner docked in Quebec City after traveling from South America. The ship can reach up to 10.5 knots and carry 1,000 tons of cargo. That's still much smaller than the mega freighters responsible for most maritime trade. But companies such as Transoceanic say this alternative transport has advantages. Along with the environmental benefits, shipping times with smaller wind-powered ships can be shorter, freight costs are less volatile, and since the fuel is free, it never runs out. Maybe what's happening is a sea change in the shipping world. This has been Your World Tonight for Friday, October 11th. I'm Tom Harrington. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and take care of each other.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.